Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. When we talk about global warming and climate change, the conversation focuses on a worldwide problem and potential solutions. But we can also help make a difference maintaining a sustainable environment on a much smaller scale in our own backyard. We can start with something called naturescaping. It will be featured Saturday at this year's Green Homes Festival at the Missouri Botanical Garden. It's just one of the environmentally friendly things we can do in and around our homes and make a difference. Here to talk about it, Gene Ponzi, the Green Resources Manager at the Earthway Center of the Missouri Botanical Garden. Angie Weber is Community Conservation Planner for the Missouri Department of Conservation. And Mitch Leachman is Executive Director of the St. Louis Audubon Society. Thank you all so much for being here. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Don.
I'd like to start with you, Gene. Naturescaping seems to be the marquee item on this Saturday's event. What's it all about?
Well, the word naturescaping, that's a nod to the conservation department, because instead of talking about biodiversity or any of those 50-cent words, connecting people with nature is a really simple way to say that. So it's using ecological principles and understanding how things are related, using native plants as the anchors and the workhorses of various functions, whether that's capturing rainwater through what we also call rainscaping or habitat creation, and getting people to interact with living things that native plants attract that other kinds of plants don't necessarily attract.
Your focus, I'm sure, is on the individual homeowner, the individual resident, as opposed to a much broader scale.
Well, Don, the Green Homes Festival has always focused on stuff for the home. It's a universe of green, but orienting that in a way through exhibitors and presentations and talks that people can really either imagine and start to plan doing it in their home, or a lot of people actually come with project ideas or projects in the works and then get to talk with the local experts about what they're doing. So that really interactive component is very home-focused. And, you know, we all live somewhere, hopefully. And that's a pretty universal way to talk about this green stuff.
All right. Well, let me move along to Angie and ask how the Conservation Department, the Department of Conservation, is coming at all of this.
Well, the Conservation Department has promoting using native plants in the landscape for a long time. There's different programs that we support, such as the Partners for Native Landscaping Workshop that's offered every spring with several local entities, including Shaw Nature Reserve and the Audubon Society. We also support the Shaw Professional Landscape Series. All of these initiatives support using native plants in the landscape. And the reason why the Conservation Department cares is because that's directly connected to our fish, forest, and wildlife of the state. And the name of the game is putting good quality habitat in the ground in these urban areas. And our local wildlife, they really face challenges with habitat loss and fragmentation and pollution and invasive species. So we just really want to promote the message that each individual person can take some responsibility and help our native species just by changing the plant composition in their yards.
And when we talk about the environment, there are a lot of dots that are connected,
yes,
are there not?
Very, very, very true. And these native plants also are just less intensive on the environment. They require less fertilizer and pesticides and irrigation, so it's just a more sustainable approach all around.
All right, let me turn to Mitch now and ask about the Audubon Society's input into all of this.
Sure. It's really exciting for us. Our mission is to connect people with nature. So for, in our case, 95 years, almost 100 years, we've been working here in the St. Louis region to do just that. We're known as bird people. We're proud of that moniker, and we do use birds through almost everything, all of our programs, to help people appreciate the outdoors and appreciate the environment in their own space. But just a couple of years ago, just 2012, we kicked off a new program called Bring Conservation Home. And it's a way that we actually go to individual homeowners' landscapes and help them understand how they can do some of what we're just talking about, how they can create little patches of habitat in their own landscape. One of my subtitles, or also known as aliases for the program, is called Habitat House Calls. Because, again, we are actually sending trained habitat advisors to individuals' homes. So it's a lot of fun, and it's been great reward for us.
So we'll call you Dr. Leachman from now on? Is that
Would
that be a, how are we doing as a region? I'll come back to you, Gene, on this. How are we doing as a region when it comes to issues conservation?
Well, you know, like every place in the first world, we consume more than we put back. Mm-hmm. The St. Louis region has so many resources. We have terrific water resources. We are in the intersection of a lot of different kinds of environments, prairie and forest and the swamps coming up from the Boot Heel. We have a phenomenal wealth of organizations that run the gamut from nonprofits and government agencies like ours to businesses and orders of nuns and municipalities and citizen science groups that are engaged with nature and connecting people to nature and resuscitating nature, if you will. We have a lot of really great resources from, you know, communication resources like yours and cultural institutions. So the messaging is really converging and strengthening around nature connection and plants as a again, the anchors, the workhorses of that. And it's something that people tend to love. It doesn't put us off. We may not be able to directly influence the lives of polar bears, but we can directly influence the lives of monarch butterflies. And that's as much saving as the polar bears with the monarchs. And that's an empowering thing, too, I think.
But there are a lot of people out there, and I'll switch over to Angie and Mitch, but a lot of people who are getting tired of this conversation about global warming and climate change, a lot of critics and doubters out there. How do you deal with that?
I guess the folks that I've talked with in my position that are maybe apprehensive about changing their train of thought, that's when I start going into just the functionality of why it makes sense to use native plants in the landscape. And when you start talking about and I usually don't even touch upon climate change because I think there's a lot more to it than just that. But just talking about, you know, the resources involved in making fertilizer and then shipping fertilizer and then applying it to your yard and then using pesticides, and they require a lot of resources to make and use as well. And that's all then going to get into our groundwaters and our streams and our lakes. And then that's the water that we're going to then drink. And so when you start just explaining how it makes sense to use these native plants and that they also have really deep root systems and they help manage stormwater better and then they provide this wildlife benefit, you know, a lot of our native insects need native plants to persist. And these native insects are then feeding most of the pretty birds that we like seeing in our yard. And you start explaining all those connections and people kind of are open-minded and they start changing their train of thought, and then they're receptive to this new idea.
It's almost too late, in a sense, is it not, with regard to what's going into our rivers? And we have areas of pollution in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm told, that are the size of New Jersey.
That's very true. There is definitely pollution in our waterways, but I don't think it's too late at all. I think this is also a behavioral shift. I think by, you know, incorporating native plants and providing that connection to nature, people start caring about the places where they live and then also, you know, just the surrounding neighborhood and then the larger community as a whole.
So, Mitch, the number of critics diminishing, do you think? On our level here, what are you hearing?
I think it is very encouraging. I mean, again, on a native landscaping standpoint, you know, we're relatively new to the game within Audubon, but as far as communicating with people, like I said, that's something we've been doing for many decades. But again, you know, it's exciting also because something that both Gene and Angie have touched on, and that is you can talk about this sort of effort. You can talk about folks, you know, opportunities to create a little bit of habitat, and you can do it without any sense of obligation on their part, without any attribution for fault or guilt, because it's simply a really exciting thing to do. I mean, there's just – I have yet to meet somebody who gets inspired by turf grass.
That's very true.
I have yet to have somebody challenge me when I tell them, you know, hey, have you ever had a moment of real thoughtful, you know, contemplation with your boxwood hedge? You know, but if you get a butterfly garden, you get a songbird garden, you get, you know, things going in your space that are little pieces of habitat – it's just really, really interesting and exciting. And I mean, it beats TV. It beats IMAX. It beats Avatar. I'm sorry, but it does.
But it doesn't beat radio.
Never.
Of course not.
Never.
Not your radio.
And when you have these kinds of interactions with people and you know, Angie, you just described ecologic, ecosystems, the fact that things are connected and they're in relationship to each other, just like the systems in our human body. Each one does its particular job, but they all have to work together to be an integrated, whole, living person. You're talking about sustainability and you're getting people to think in systems, and that's a transformation. And I think when I do that, I I almost always experience people getting excited and they're interested and they're learning something new. Neurons are firing or whatever is happening there. It's a different thing than if you're just saying, well, this and then that.
You know, I can almost see you, Gene, clench your fists when I talk about critics out there. You don't like to hear that word.
They're there. Of course I know that, Don. And, you know, here we are. We are the last industrialized country where we're still debating whether climate change is happening or not. And I realize that that is a reality. And I don't talk about climate change directly either as a lead-in, but all of these things do relate. And the Cuyahoga River in Ohio used to catch fire.
Oh, I remember,
we can turn things around. We can make changes. We can reclaim. And individuals have a lot of influence in that way in some of these kinds of actions.
In promoting this program, I said the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about individuals on a very small basis doing a little bit comparatively to make a difference.
And collectively having that add up. The mayor's, Mayor Slay's, Monarchs for Milkweeds initiative. You know, we're right smack in the middle of the 2,500-mile monarch migratory flyway between Michoacán in Mexico and the boreal forests of Canada. And along that flyway here in the middle, we can revitalize some of the monarch habitat, and working with other communities up and down that flyway, people networked, social networking, citizen science actions like Monarch Watch and Monarch Way Stations out of KU in Kansas, that is really a possible phenomenon.
Mitch, so we lose the monarch butterfly. What do we really lose?
Oh, you're really asking that question. I don't think we know. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges to, again, some of this thought process, this, you know, approach that we have through our society and our culture. You know, it's one thing to go to, you know, a fast food restaurant, you know, and have a quote, a throwaway a meal. But do we really want to take our, you know, a disposable and consumer-oriented thought process and apply it to our environment? I mean, because that's really what we do when we ponder that idea. Well, so what if the polar bear doesn't exist in the wild anymore? We have zoos. I mean, really? I mean, a disposable society is essentially the way that thought process goes. And I don't want to live in that place.
You know, it's a lot easier, I think, for us to understand that. I'm taking the conversation in this direction for the moment to help people understand why these things are important. I mean, we've talked about it enough in this program that I think I understand that. But it's a lot easier to understand what could and would happen if, as a result of bee colony collapse, for instance, we lost bees, what that would mean to our society and to our world. It would kill it, would it not? Where are we with all of that stuff now? Angie?
Well, and I think we should be concerned about the loss of an entire butterfly species, and especially if, you know, you consider that the female butterfly, for example, lays her eggs on milkweed species. She's very specific to that genus of plant because the caterpillar has to have milkweed to feed off of, you know, to grow and turn into a butterfly. So, and we know caterpillars are the main food source for songbirds. That's what they feed their young. So what if there's songbirds out there that are very specific to only feeding their young monarch caterpillars? So then that bird species might decline as well. So it's that cascade effect. So I think that's why we need to be really concerned about if this monarch species completely disappears, because it's very interrelated to other things.
And the little kid who sees a monarch, which is such an iconic, it's such a recognizable butterfly, and the caterpillars are yellow and green and black striped, and they can be that vivid because they'll poison you if you eat them. They can, you know, they can tolerate that. And the plants that they grow on, the chrysalis that the monarch catches out of, what if no kid were able to see that again? It's the same kind of ethic that says, well, you know, if one kid is shot somewhere, what's the big difference? We need to change our value about individuals and groups in this society. Nature doesn't select for individuals, but we have a lot of caring for individuals, and we can translate that societal, that you know, learned caring into caring for the groups as well and valuing them.
Well, now that we have established, I think, what is at stake, let's take a break and come back and talk about some of the things that we can do to make it a better place. And we'll do that in just a moment. My guests in studio are Gene Ponzi, from whom you just heard, the Green Resources Manager at the Earthway Center of Missouri Botanical Garden. Also with us in studio is Angie Weber, Community Conservation Planner with the Missouri Department of Conservation, and Mitch Leachman is Executive Director of the St. Louis Audubon Society. We'll come back to continue this conversation, and we certainly want to bring you into it, because I think a lot of folks out there may have a lot of questions about the things we're talking about. If you have questions or comments about greening your own personal environment, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you prefer to send us a tweet, we'll take it at STL On Air. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Gene Ponzi, Angie Weber, and Mitch Leachman. We're talking about our own personal environment and things we can do to make it a better place. We've established, I think, that so many of the things that we're talking about are interconnected. John Donne said, no man is an island, right? And that really applies to our environment as well. But what can we do? Gene, you've alluded to a couple of things that folks can do. Let's get a little more specific. I mean, not everybody lives in a house with a yard. I don't have a balcony where I live, and I don't have a yard. So there's not much that I can do. Or is there? Give me some sense of the kinds of things people can do.
Well, if you don't have a balcony and you don't have a yard, is it possible to share a little piece of patio with someone? Is there anything that you can do in your workplace? Can you get involved in any of the volunteer organizations that, you know, Forest Park Forever has a lot of volunteers. Missouri Botanical Garden, of course, does. Audubon Society does. To be able to have that direct experience of connecting with nature. And when I talk to people about what you have in your yard, I have to say I'm getting more and more anti-turf. The older I get, I'm getting less tolerant of that green carpet and what it takes to maintain it. That is my bias. But I'm not saying rip out your knockout roses and your butterfly bush, which, yeah, goes yoo-hoo to the butterfly, but doesn't support its life because it's native to China. But when you're looking for something new, look to the natives. Look to the plants and the choices that really do well here and integrate them with what you're already doing.
But, you know, I heard you, and again, I'll be devil's advocate here, I heard you talking with producer Mary Edwards before we went on the air,
yeah.
And she was saying that her neighbors don't like the idea of these native plants. I don't personally know what the objection might be. What is the objection? How do you deal with that?
Well, people tend to think of natives, often you think of them as prairie plants, and prairie plants can get very floppy. They can get very untidy in the home garden. So the prairie look is not necessarily the thing to start with. Borders, leave a little border, leave a little edge along where your native plants are. Do a little island of butterfly gardening and take a little island out of what you have to mow out of your zoysia or your fescue and start with a little bit and then grow from there. And for communities where there might be concerns about the weedy and the untidy look, Missouri Grow Native, our native plant organization, has developed a model native plant ordinance that community local governments can use to actually evaluate and advise residents and then say, well, this is actually within the bounds of what we allow here, in the same way that there are ordinances now that allow keeping chickens.
And you
go ahead, Angie.
You can also landscape in different ways with native plants. So you can create a formal look if you clump like species together, put taller species in the back, use native plants as a ground cover or a border. You can landscape in ways that's still traditional and that's appealing and it has the aesthetics that most people are looking for. The Grow Native website also has design templates based on, I think, shade requirements and light requirements and different design ideas to give people ideas about what they can do in their yard. And it's not just prairie plants. Woodland plants are great to landscape with. They're adapted to shade and they don't spread as easily. They don't get as tall. So there's definitely a lot of different things that you can do with native plants if you're willing to devote just a little bit of time to do some research and explore all the resources that are out there and to, consider some alternatives.
And they're more likely to thrive as well because they are native.
They will definitely thrive. They might need a little attention the first year to get them established, especially if we, have a drought. But after that, they are very hardy, tolerant plants. They can take wet conditions and dry conditions, and the wildlife love them as well.
Mitch, go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, no, you're fine. An important point, and again, directly connected to what Gene and Angie have already said, is We have enough commercially available native plants. We have hundreds of species of commercially available native plants that it really is about what look the homeowner wants to achieve. And with some of the standard gardening principles, and they are gardening principles, the idea of, you know, clumping of plants and, you know, using mulch and what have you, those are the same thoughts that the average gardener would use with their ornamental plants. So it's just a matter of picking the right plants for the right location for the look that the homeowner is desiring. And again, through principles like borders and hardscape and, you know, maybe even, you know, a border of turf grass, for example. And all of that shows your neighbors, it shows the community, it shows everybody what your intentions were in the space. We didn't just stop mowing, we planted this stuff. This is supposed to be here, this is a butterfly garden, etc. And it assuages almost all concerns.
And there's no law against talking to your neighbors about what you're doing, what
Amen.
You're planning, and maybe bringing them in on the concept, right? I want to take a phone call right away because it brings us to another issue we wanted to get to. So let's have Kathy and Festus do it for us. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to talk about gathering the rainwater. And on your other program sometime back, you had somebody on there, one of the experts, and they said that you don't get very much water off the roof and you have to collect it for a long time. Well, I use those 18-gallon totes with the lids, and I can get 18 gallons of water if the rain is a nice, low rain. I can get that in 15 to 20 minutes.
Kathy, thanks for the call. We had no trouble getting rainwater off the roof this morning, and most of this area. Jane, pick up on that and this whole idea of using our rainwater.
Well, we have a lot of water in the St. Louis area. We are really a water-rich area, and yet getting it for the right place and the right time, not having it overload things like our sewer system, the garden sort of gathered those strategies together over a time period, working with experts like the Conservation Department and the Department of Natural Resources, Shaw Nature Reserve, professional landscapers. We call that rainscaping, and there's a whole bunch of strategies from what Kathy described there. You're using totes as opposed to a rain barrel, which hopefully that's easy enough for you to handle and it's not straining your back and not breeding mosquitoes. But there's all kinds of ways to work with your driveway, your sidewalk, having pervious paving, rain gardens, bioswales, taking turf out and using the natives that Angie said have deeper roots. The goal there is to capture water where it falls and use it if you can. Take it out of that rain barrel or out of those totes and use it to water your containers, or let it percolate back down through the groundwater instead of running off and overloading the sewer systems. That's what rainscaping is all about. And MSD has adopted this kind of green infrastructure strategy all over the country. Sewer utilities are talking green infrastructure because we can't afford to rebuild our sewer systems. But localizing that water collection is something we can do.
But, Angie, can we afford to rainscape? How expensive is it?
I think it depends on the practice and probably where you live, how much stormwater you have coming, you know, onto your property. I know I had a corner of my backyard that was staying wet for a long period of time. I was able to just change the plants. I just took out the grass, put in native irises and sedges and flowering plants, and that area looks beautiful. It's more aesthetically pleasing, providing wildlife value. I didn't change the soil. I just worked with the existing conditions. That area is away from my house. I know there's other things you do have to consider if you've got, you know, rain that you need to manage near the building. But like I said, I think you can go as inexpensive as you want, or some of the practices can be more expensive, especially if you need an engineer to help you out and provide recommendations with the driveway or a rain garden that might need an underdrain, that sort of thing.
And, you know, like anything, there's an investment up front when you're creating something, when you're establishing something. But, you know, one of many reasons that Gene's really passionate about turf grass is it's a maintenance, right? I mean, you know, whether you're cutting it, whether you're watering it, whether you're spreading fertilizer on it, you know, you establish a space, a butterfly garden, a rain garden, a bioswale with native plants. And as Angie said, once those plants are established, they typically require no supplemental watering. They're not looking for fertilizers. You know, they evolved in this part of the country, and they're perfectly happy with our hot and sweaty summers, and they're perfectly happy with our cold and bitter winters. We had homeowners in 2012. We all remember the 90-day extended drought and 110-degree temperatures in 2012. I was in a landscape at the end of the summer, and I don't know how many different species the homeowner had, but it was a rainscape. It was dominant about water, and there was a dry creek bed, and there was all these wonderful plants. I don't know how many were in bloom at the end of the summer, and she had not watered a drop. Those were established native plants, and they were perfectly fine.
Go ahead, Jean.
And there's an economic advantage to making this switch, too, because the lawn care companies don't have to go out of business. We need companies. We need consultants that know how to maintain this kind of landscape. So Angie mentioned the Shaw Professional Landscape Series, training for landscapers and for companies in the green industry, meaning the plant care mm-hmm. industry, to grow the plants, to be able to design and plant the plants and maintain them. There is definitely an economic sector growth there possible right along with the growth of the plants.
While we're on the subject of watering, we may have covered most of it, but Karen in University City has written an email saying, can you have a guest talk about water usage, especially rain barrels and sprinkling lawns. Nothing frustrates me more than seeing people watering their yards during the hottest part of the day. Have we pretty much gone over that?
Well, when we had our last really droughty summer, Don, we have some, I would call it grass because it looks like that, but it's mostly a mix of stuff in my yard and a lot of trees. And we did water the trees that summer, but I moved the sprinkler around the trees and let the grass in the middle poop out. That was less mowing that I had to do. You can't get enough water pressure out of a rain barrel to sprinkle. You can water things close to the rain barrel with a trickle hose, or you can take water out and water your containers with a watering can. It's, you know, there are places in the country where you're fined if you water your lawn. We have not gotten to that point yet here.
I have Karen has written something else here pertaining to an earlier part of our conversation. We'll just make her comment known. A friend of mine has planted milkweed and has raised three groups of monarch butterflies in her backyard.
Ooh.
The monarch program can provide plants and guidance, even certify your yard as a habitat for monarchs. It's also a great way to teach kids about the importance of native habitats. I have not heard of this monarch program.
It started at KU, at University of Kansas in Lawrence. Chip Taylor, Dr. Orly R. Chip Taylor, started it. He had been studying killer bees in Mexico and happened to be in the area where the butterflies overwinter, monarchs overwinter, and got interested in monarchs, got a tagging program started to be able to trace the monarchs up and down their flyway. That was called Monarch Watch. It's a really major citizen science program. And as the monarch watchers were noticing a decline in the population, the shift moved into what's called monarch way stations, which was one of the early promotions of planting milkweed intentionally along that flyway.
All right. Anything to add from you? Okay. Let me touch upon a couple of things before we go back to the phones. And we have some lines open. I'll remind our audience that 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Let's come back to the chickens in the yard, Jean. You mentioned that a moment ago. And, you know, right. Well, we have one in the studio, it would appear. You know, I can see a lot of folks saying, I don't want the people next door to have chickens in their yard. Why do I want chickens in my yard?
Well, you want chickens because if you have kids, your kids can interact with the chickens. They can learn about where the food comes from. The eggs from chickens that you know are so far superior to commercially produced eggs. Chickens clean up a lot of stuff. They eat a lot of food scraps out of your kitchen. They eat bugs. They're kind of pleasant. They're kind of funny. Chickens are one of the most phenomenally popular green things happening in people's backyards, and there are people who may say, I don't want chickens next to my yard. But generally, in my experience, the chicken owners are pretty good ambassadors for the chickens, and you walk over to that neighbor's yard and you give them a half a dozen eggs every now and then, and you may just win over your neighbor.
Are you seeing more of this, Angie?
Yes, and urban agriculture actually isn't something that's directly related to what the Conservation Department promotes, but we're obviously in favor of anything that just supports more sustainable practices. I think it's great to buy or raise products as locally as you can, supporting local economies, just really creating a healthy ecosystem. And that is related to just implementing as many practices as you can at home that's more sustainable and less resource intensive.
In general, do local ordinances look favorably upon this?
Yes, and there are a number of local ordinances. The public works officials, the other official city managers that would be dealing with this kind of stuff, they're talking to each other in and around the St. Louis area municipalities. So there are plenty of precedents to allow. I mean, maybe it's the number of chickens. In the city of St. Louis, I think you can have a total of 4 pets. You could have 3 chickens and 1 dog and no roosters. So the ordinance varies community by community, and there are certainly some places that will not allow it yet, although, you know, out in town and country, there are those green proponents that are still trying to get the fowl amid the hostas.
You have a way with words, Gene Ponzi. Let me tell you.
Move over, Bambi.
This is an appropriate time to go to Lori calling from University City while we're talking about chickens. Go ahead, Lori.
I just wanted to say that I have a neighbor with chickens, and one of the things that's so great is the sound of them. They make this wonderful soft, burbling little sound like a babbling brook or a wind chime or something, and so people don't need to worry about noise. It's really great.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for the call. You all happy to hear that call from Lori, are you not?
It's interesting. I think we used the word interconnected early in our conversation about the environment and about nature and all of its connections. What we've seen with the over 300 surveys that we've done in the last 2 years is individuals have interconnections within their own landscapes now. And so we see a lot of people reaching out to us with assistance for native landscaping, and they may already have chickens. We see a lot of people reaching out to us that have herb gardens or veggie gardens. So we're seeing, you know, interconnections within the personal landscapes, and that's just really awesome.
While we're talking about critters, let's talk about bees for a moment, and I'll direct this to you, Mitch. I know that's one of the things, beehives are one of the things that will be presented in part of your event on Saturday. Aside from the obvious, the pollination part of it, why is it a good idea to have beehives in your property?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on beehives. If folks are interested in pursuing beehives, if they don't already have them, we refer them to like the Eastern Missouri Beekeepers Association and folks that are, kind of practice that directly. But you know, Angie mentioned this earlier. We don't necessarily know this, you know, on an average day-to-day basis with the average individual, but bees are food for other animals as well. There's a couple of Missouri songbirds that are specialists at eating bees and wasps. Well, imagine that. Mm-hmm. I had one in my yard late last year, and I do believe it was actually fly-catching, pursuing bees that were visiting my asters. I mean, that's just fascinating. Again, especially if you have kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, neighbor kids, I mean, how much better does it get to have, you know, those sorts of interactions going on in your own landscape?
Anyone want to add to that before we take another break?
Well, hobby beekeeping is really helping to resuscitate honeybee populations, which are suffering because of varroa mite infestations and colony collapse disorder. There are also an awful lot of native bees. Big bumblebees are native bees, and solitary bees and wasps. Bats pollinate, butterflies, birds pollinate. One species of fly, the midge fly, pollinates all chocolate. We need pollinators. We need these relationships. Need I say more? That's really true. And when we understand where that stuff comes from, the U.S. produces 80-some percent of all the almonds in the world, and the California almond crop is totally pollinated by honeybees that gets trucked around from hive to hive. So we have a real reliance on these critters, and we could have a relationship with them as well.
Yeah, and it's a very serious issue, this collapse issue.
Yes.
You stop to think about what could happen as a result of a spread of this. You just heard from Gene Ponzi, who is the Green Resources Manager at the Earthway Center at the Missouri Botanical Garden. Also with me in studio is Angie Weber, Community Conservation Planner with the Missouri Department of Conservation. Mitch Leachman is Executive Director of the St. Louis Audubon Society. Welcome back. Continue our conversation and take your questions too, 382-8255 if you want to get into the conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation. We are talking about the environment, our personal environment, and things that we can do to help preserve it and make it better. My guests in studio are Gene Ponzi, Angie Weber, and Mitch Leachman. A reminder, too, to our audience that one of the reasons we're having the conversation here today is the fact that the Green Homes Festival, this year's Green Homes Festival, is scheduled for this Saturday from 9 to 4 at the Missouri Botanical Garden. And many of the things that we're talking about here will be on display and talked about further on Saturday from 9 to 4 at the Garden. There are a couple of things I'd just like to get quick responses to from you folks that are going to be available for discussion and on display at the Garden this Saturday. Let me just run down the list. I saw something, Gene, about an outdoor kitchen. You know, to me, an outdoor kitchen is a Weber kettle. Right.
Okay. That would be a good part of it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's where you cook, where you grill your salmon.
Yep. Yep.
And then you have your other little burner where you can steam your vegetables and stuff. I think summer kitchens and outdoor kitchens are wonderful places to be. You know, if you had a screen porch with a ceiling fan and you could cook outdoors, you could be outdoors even in our St. Louis summers and be protected from mosquitoes and enjoy that without cooking.
You're talking basically about barbecue type equipment, are you not?
With some of that kind of stuff, you know, and there's gas grills and there's things like that. The outdoor kitchen at the Kemper Center for Home Gardening has a sink, it has grilling kinds of facilities, it has tables. That's one of the places where we'll be having our presentations to the people, our green living talks on Saturday.
What about cold frame vegetable gardening?
Well, cold frames they're boxes, literally, that you can lift the lid up and you can start your plants earlier, or you can even grow plants like spinach and lettuce all year long, all winter long, in cold frame types of situations. So they extend the growing season for the types of plants, generally greens, not root kinds of plants, that will flourish throughout the winter months if they're protected from the extremes of weather.
And Mitch, in your participation on Saturday, what's that going to involve?
We will be highlighting our Bring Conservation Home program. We have a couple of advisors that will be helping us staff the table that day and providing information to folks, again, how they can do this in their own personal spaces. And one of the key points that I make, whether I'm talking to an individual at an event like the Green Homes Festival or delivering a presentation to a garden club, and hopefully this message is also coming through today, is you can do this in your space, and you can do it with little supplemental help. Creating a butterfly garden is very simple and doesn't require a lot of space. I started native plant gardening in my yard with about 50 square feet, a little tiny strip along the side of my carport, and that became my initial butterfly garden. And again, the Grow Native is a great website that gives an awful lot of real easy resources as well.
We've talked a lot and focused a lot on people who have gardens and have the space to do the kind of thing you're talking about. What can folks who have only a balcony do to be a part of all of the kinds of things that we're talking about?
Container gardening is something that we had briefly talked about before the show started. And Scott Woodbury recently did a container gardening class out at the Native Plant School. I forget the phrase, but it was a very straightforward concept of basically, you know, if it grows, put it in a pot. It was really broad and simple. But there's an important concept here. And while a plant might live longer if it's in the ground, in its established habitat, the perennial might last 15 years. Maybe in a pot, it only lasts a few years. There's things like, you know, winter that you would need to be concerned about, that, you know, the roots might dry out, those sorts of things. But container gardening is a real solid option for anybody with a patio, a deck, a balcony, a small space that they just don't have a lot of, soil. But another thing that just briefly I'll mention that comes up again consistently for us and also would apply to folks that have tiny spaces is providing a little water for birds, for butterflies, for bees, because it turns out all of those other animals need water too. I was at a space not long ago, happened to be a yard, but again, you could do this with a balcony, and the homeowner had multiple bird baths okay, just shallow, you know, containers with water. One of them was for the birds and the other one was for the bees. And while we stood there, bee after bee after bee came. They had hives. They had honeybees. And they were lining up to get the water. I mean, that was just insane, but it was also just so
they made a beeline.
Inspiring. It was great. Yeah.
You know, with all of this water around to do the kinds of things you're talking about, Mitch, what about mosquito problems? People don't want that standing water.
No, and that is really a major hazard. You want to be able to monitor the places on your property where water can stand. That means keeping your gutters clean. That means if you have that kind of corrugated drain pipe that sometimes comes out under the ground from your downspout, either put a rain barrel under your downspout so the water isn't flowing through that pipe where it sits in the corrugations. You can use mosquito dunks, which are like little donuts of BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a biological larvicide that you don't want to throw in living water, but in places where standing water, like in your rain barrel, that birds are not going to get into and your pets are not going to get into, you want to create the condition where larvae cannot reproduce. And you want to monitor things like your muck buckets. If you keep those on your property upended in the little rim around there, after it rains, water collects. And after a day or two, mosquitoes will breed in there. So do be very vigilant about where mosquitoes breed. In your swimming pool, in your wheelbarrow, you want to dump that stuff out. You want to clean it out, and you want to encourage you want to work with your neighbors to make sure that they're not breeding mosquitoes too. Flowing water is not an issue, and in rain gardens, the water will percolate down within a day or two, so it's not standing water long enough to breed mosquitoes. That's part of how those landscape features are built.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mitch.
Bird baths are often a misconception as a place where mosquitoes would breed. And as Gene mentioned, the larvae need static, stagnant, still water for an extended period of time, up to about a week. So if your bird bath is being visited by birds, almost by definition, it's being disturbed. And also, they're going to splash it out. They're going to drink. It's going to evaporate. I know in the middle of a St. Louis summer, I'm filling my bird baths almost daily. So it's really never a mosquito issue, so long as that bird bath, again, is being visited by birds, being looked at by the homeowner.
And a lot of birds like mosquitoes, too, as dinner, do they not?
Some birds. Dragonflies in the insect kingdom and bats are actually our primary insect eater. Most birds that you see flying, they're eating other flying insects. And, of course, most of our birds are active during the day, and our mosquitoes are primarily, a dusk.
Sure. Let's go back to our email list here from Jeff. He writes, can the guests comment on ways to fix the nitrogen in your garden soil? Besides using chemical fertilizers, rotating bean plants is common. Are there other ways in plants? Anybody have any ideas, Gene?
Oh, Jeff, you're talking to the green girl here, not the petunia girl from the Missouri Botanical Garden. I would say visit to really get good information about that for gardeners, visit mobot.org, the garden's website, and go through the you can type in your question there, and you'll get to a circular that will literally answer your question. I'm sorry, all I can grow is basil because I have so many trees, I don't have room for anything bigger.
Yeah. We'll have a link to your website, by the way, on our website as well. Janice in Illinois writes, are there any pest control or weed control options that are okay? I was scared after listening to a pitch by Altera, which actually treats the perimeter of the yard to manage pests in the house. I found this to be very concerning.
What pests are you managing? Are you trying to kill spiders outside? Spiders are useful predators. If you're trying to get the aphids off your garden plants, you want to use something that preys on aphids. If you're trying to get rid of mosquitoes, spraying will kill some adult mosquitoes that it touches, but it won't interrupt the breeding cycle. So that is marketing claims. That is adding poisons to your environment that are not necessary.
And Jean kind of brought up a good point. If these are outside pests that you're referring to, if you change your plant palette and you start landscaping with native plants, you actually want to see your leaves getting munched on. That's a really good thing to attract these native insects. You want to see them in your garden because other things will then show up that will eat those insects and keep everything in check. You'll have this self-sustaining ecosystem right there at home. And it's just kind of developing, I think, a tolerance and an understanding and realizing that those insects aren't going to bother you. They're there for a purpose, and they're providing a huge ecological benefit to our native wildlife.
We have another email here. Are the panelists working with any local developers to change behavior to reach the mass consumer? Gene, I would have to think that you'd fall into that category.
Well, yes. The Missouri Botanical Garden is, through our relationship with the U.S. Green Building Council and the Green Business Challenge and the Shaw Professional Landscaping Series. We're not so much yet out into the development profession, but with what's called the green industry, the landscaping business and the plant growers and the designers and the implementers, we are working in a network to change the practices, change the, to some extent, the regulations. That takes longer, and also to help evolve aesthetics.
How about the Department of Conservation?
Through my position, which is Community Conservation Planner, the department does sponsor various workshops, conferences. We are a member of the American Planning Association, where we do promote conservation-friendly practices. We do try to work with developers, planners that are employed by the various municipalities in St. Louis to try to help people understand that natural resource stewardship is very important, that it's to everyone's advantage to leave a forest or a wetland or another ecologically sensitive area intact and develop around it, because all of those ecosystem services that habitat provides is very important to us and our quality of life. So the department is definitely very interested, and we have programs and funding and different things that we do to work with communities and developers to try to encourage the development to occur in the right way.
Like, talk about the tree canopy data.
So I know Forest Relief of Missouri and the Missouri Department of Conservation did a tree canopy assessment for St. Louis, and they collected data to assess how our tree canopy compares to other cities. I think it was a little bit lower than most. I think 20% is our current tree canopy, and I think the average was in the 30s somewhere. So we definitely are collaborating with local entities, the Regional Planning Commission, and are trying to encourage communities to implement different practices that encourage a healthy community urban forest.
And the tree canopy is important. Why? Because of air quality?
Trees are important for a lot of different reasons. They provide energy efficiency for our buildings. They sequester carbon. They provide wildlife value. They enhance the aesthetics of the neighborhood. They increase livability, encouraging people to get out and walk their neighborhood. But they also are very outstanding methods of managing stormwater. If a tree lives to be 50 years old, they'll have a healthy tree. It'll have a large tree canopy that will collect a lot of rainwater, and 35% of it could evaporate back into the atmosphere. So you have a smaller percentage that actually hits the ground. In a natural setting, that water is going to infiltrate into the ground and not be runoff. But in our urban areas, because of the impervious pavement, we have more runoff. So when we have healthy trees that have a large area to grow, they're going to absorb a lot of that stormwater and manage it where it falls on site.
Only about a minute left, Gene. We've just scratched the surface of some of the things that's going to be talked about and presented at the event on Saturday. But very quickly, there are things inside the house and around the house, not living things that you'll be displaying as well, such as?
Don, the Green Homes Festival covers energy efficiency, home building, home remodeling, how to keep your home clean, the kinds of materials that you can use to redecorate your home that are going to be sustainable materials and won't introduce pollutants into your home. There are so many resources for everything in and around your home, and this year at the 13th Annual Green Homes Festival, because it's being held on the grounds of the Kemper Center for Home Gardening, in that plant-based environment, we're really featuring naturescaping and rainscaping, too, the kinds of plant things we've been talking about today.
And new products as well, I assume.
Oh,
that's
yes,
always
yes,
part of what you
definitely.
Do.
Definitely. That's Saturday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Missouri Botanical Garden, the Green Homes Festival.
We have more information on that at our website at sglpublicradio.org. Gene Ponzi, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck on Saturday. I know it's a big day. Angie Weber, thank you for being with us. And Mitch Leachman, thank you for being with us. Hope you all have a great time on Saturday.
Thank you, Don.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with veterans of World War II as we commemorate the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.